are listening to the INCJ podcast, Conversations about International Criminal Justice.
Okay, colleagues, a formal welcome to all our guests today. Thanks so much for attending this follow-up session, our roundtable, to discuss digital, AI and rehabilitation. This event is coordinated by INCJ and in collaboration with the Probation Institute. I think this is the third in a series, but this is our second event that follows on from an event last month. We ran a webinar with some wonderful researchers presenting their current work on rehabilitation and justice and technology. So today we want to be a little bit more fluid and have opportunities for everyone to discuss some reflections maybe from the webinar last week, but also we've kindly had some feedback from people that attended the last session, and that's helped inform what we're going to do today. We have some wonderful guests to be our discussants for the roundtable, and I'll briefly introduce them. But I would like to ask all our roundtable people if what they hope to get out of today's session once I've introduced you. So I will start with, I don't know who's further away from me here in the UK, but I'm guessing it's Matias Amorim from Brazil, Sao Paulo in Brazil. Welcome, Matias. What do you hope to get out of today's session?
Hi, everybody. It's nice to be here with you all. I'm hoping for this table talk so we can discuss lots of examples around the world, and we can really get a little bit of a better clue on how AI uses and technologies have been driving some other transformations in our context.
Okay. Thank you, Matias. And another guest we have is Edgar Kuhimza. If I pronounced that right, Edgar?
Yeah.
Yes, thank you, Edgar. Edgar is the e-governance expert for the Ugandan government, working for the Ministry of Justice. Edgar, what do you hope to get out of today's session?
Well, hi, Victoria. Hi, everybody. Happy to be here today, and greetings from Uganda. I really hope that today we can be able to shine a spotlight on inter-sectoral or multi-stakeholder contributions to digital rehabilitation in terms of how we can be able to leverage our collective efforts across government agencies, but also with other players and partners in the civil society space. Because it's quite a dynamic space, as you know, but how can we be able to leverage all that, you know, collectively to be able to have a digitally driven rehabilitation? And so I'm looking forward to our thoughts and ideas around that, Victoria. Hopefully also from other jurisdictions that are quite different from mine.
Yes. Thank you, Edgar. And another wonderful guest is Carl Mumford, who is an expert on criminal justice and neurodiversity, and acts as a consultant working in and around this space. Welcome, Carl. What do you hope to get out of today's session?
Thanks, Victoria. Hi, everyone. So, my name's Carl. I have a background in policing. I was a police officer for 14 years. And my interest is in neurodiversity and how the criminal justice system intersects with it. So my aims for this session is when we're talking about AI and rehabilitation and learning and how people learn, for me, it's how people understand the systems they're using, their learning preferences, what happens when, for instance, they are dyslexic and they have challenges with using a particular piece of software, or they have challenges with understanding the theory of mind if they're autistic, how these all of these things happen with the human brain. Hopefully we can use that information to improve their outcomes and improve the understanding of neurodiversity in the criminal justice system. So, yeah, thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you, Carl. And another guest we have for our roundtable discussion is David Rahu. Welcome, David. You're an all-round expert on AI design. You're a PhD candidate. You have lots of experience working in the criminal justice system. What do you hope to get out of today's session?
Thanks, Victoria. Just to hear from everybody else, really, and gather up, you know, views. And it's a rare opportunity, really, just to hear from a good variety, a good, you know, diverse range of people about the sort of things that, you know, I deal with day in, day out as part of both my job and my research. So really looking forward to hearing from everybody else, really.
And I've noticed on the list, Glyn Davis, are you there?
I am, yes.
Hooray. Welcome back, Glyn. You're the only surviving person who's willing to return. Thank you, Glyn. Some of you may have caught Glyn. Glyn is the Service Development Director for Breaking Free, which is part of Telus Health. What do you hope to get out of today, Glyn, as a discussant at our round table?
Yeah, without being boring and kind of parroting David and Carl, it's kind of learning really from everyone else, trying to identify sort of what some of the successes have been and kind of examples of best practice. We know the IT infrastructure, particularly within prisons, is challenging. We know there's lots of obstacles to the implementation ongoing delivery and evaluation of particularly digital interventions. So it'll be interesting to hear from other territories outside of the UK. Although we've got experience of working in the US and some experience of Canada, it'll be really interesting to hear from other parts of the world in terms of their experiences and kind of anything we can learn from other parts of the world, really.
Okay. Thanks so much, Glyn. So we have a diverse group of discussants for our roundtable. Helen, could I kindly hand over to you now to kind of initiate the next part of the proceedings? Thank you.
You can. Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. I'm Helen Schofield. I'm the Chief Executive of the Probation Institute. So we're working in collaboration with INCJ. Over the webinar we brought you back in February and today's roundtable. And I just want to kind of reflect for a moment on the webinar. I know not everybody was there, and then just think a little bit about today. We had some really interesting presentations at the webinar. We had presentations about the use of tablets in prisons. We had presentations around Breaking Free Online, the very interesting app. And we also had a presentation about remote hearings. It set me thinking, as it would, because they were fascinating discussions. And as I was thinking more and more about the various uses of technology in justice and rehabilitation, some thoughts in an email came through to us from Simon Bonk, who I think is on this call, from Telio. And thank you to Simon, because some very helpful questions emerged from your notes. And it seems to me, you know, that thinking about this as we've gone on since the webinar, tech and AI is a very innovative and a very exploratory field. As it moves into the field of rehabilitation and justice at quite a pace, we need to recognise that rehabilitation and justice is also quite a risky area for systems that have the capacity to, let's say, self-govern, and systems that are being very plurally developed. So I was thinking more about these uses, and just kind of seems to me that we need to reflect on tech and AI in various different uses, really. There's quite a lot of development. Can we just go back to the previous slide? Thank you. So we're looking at AI and tech supporting and helping and enabling with administrative tasks. We're looking at its use in the assessment of individuals around risk and need. We're also looking at it in the context of remote hearings and actual judicial processes. And we're looking at recording and more reporting. We're also beginning to see, as in, you know, chatbots and breaking free online, a much more kind of potential for therapeutic application, information sources at people's disposal, readily, quickly at their disposal, of course. And we're also increasingly, certainly in the UK, seeing tech and AI being brought more to the purposes of monitoring and surveillance. And so my next point really is that in the context of justice and rehabilitation, I personally, and I don't think any of us can take it for granted, that any of those above uses is kind of necessarily and essentially benign. Any one of them has the potential to be to build in unintentional bias around language, for example, or as Mike Nellis, and I don't know if Mike Nellis is on this call, but has pointed out on occasions, you know, the chatbot doesn't need to be a benign chatbot. It's all, you know, there is a lot in the design, and we'll come on to the governance issues. So just to kind of remind ourselves what rehabilitation is about, but it's essentially, it's a human interaction. It's relational. It's informed because the people practicing rehabilitation have done a lot of learning and a lot of studying. They didn't arrive, untaught. They are constantly reflective, responsive, empathetic, and resilient. And what seems to me absolutely fundamental as we move at pace is that technology must support that those primary purposes, and it must not subvert them. So the questions that we ask about all of those uses, we could have the next slide, seem to me to be absolutely fundamental. So these are some thoughts that Simon Bonk shared with us, and what we hope we'll kind of turn these into some questions for the group to think about this afternoon. So this is about organisation and governance, and it's key, isn't it? The purpose needs to be clearly articulated and anchored in rehabilitative outcomes, not technology for its own sake. The executive ownership is key, because I think we're probably all very much aware that the speed of the advancement of technology and AI is hugely dependent on private IT companies. But actually, the direction and the purposing and the how and the learning must be owned and steered by the professional leadership of the rehabilitation and justice arena, and that must then become part of their core business. So in doing so, it's essential that we integrate ethics, values, proper procurement processes, data protection, and the frontline perspective aligned with all of that. And I don't know at the moment whether we are aligning frontline perspectives with the speed of development, with some of the pilots that are moving around globally. So Simon also made the helpful suggestion about comparing risk. And it's an interesting concept, isn't it? The decisions about tech should be made explicitly comparing the risks of digital adoption with the risks of not adopting digital, with the risks of maintaining the current processes. Not that you necessarily want to maintain the current processes, but that actually you need to understand, you know, there are risks and there are risks, there will be future risks. Let's be clear. So digital literacy and capability development seems essential too, and that's another reason why the executive ownership is so critical, because practitioners, the field, probation service in England and Wales, it's equivalent wherever you go, need to be digitally literate as well. And we know, we see that new generation of practitioners coming into the field are more digitally literate than I will ever be, thank goodness. But it is absolutely fundamental that they should be, and that they are competent not only in the use of digital, but also they understand data. They understand where data is coming from. They understand what data means, and they understand why they're using technology, that they are using potentially something that is contracted through another agency, and they are in the front line of understanding the nature of that contract, and that fundamentally then they are must be the people who share in the understanding and the ownership of the evaluation of systems. So thank you to Simon for that. It helped me to kind of move from where we were to where I'd like to go this afternoon. And Rob has very kindly, we can see the next slide, put that together into some helpful questions. And these are the prompts for the discussion in the discussions that we are, I hope, about to have. Thanks. So we need Rob, I think, to help us at this point.
Yeah. So thank you, Helen. What we're going to do now, colleagues, is divide our listeners today, our participants today, into breakout groups. There's a lot of issues there that have been kindly highlighted by Helen. So what we thought was that we would, Rob, who is our technological whiz, will randomly put you into how many groups, Rob, are we looking at? Is it going to be 4 or 5 groups?
We've got 40 participants, so I'd like, let's see, should go for 5 groups.
Yeah. So, and that we've got sort of 4 key discussion prompts, haven't we? Do we want to randomly allocate, or are we going to let the groups just choose the topic they want to discuss?
Well, I think each one is a huge topic in itself. So if you're aware of what, they'll stay in the chat and I can repeat them again. But if you want to choose one, if you decide you just want to discuss one, that's fine. If you can get through the ball, that's great as well. So it's like what we'd like you to do is report back by putting your comments in the chat, though, rather than we're not going to do a report back session. So if you can make notes as you go along, and then if there's any problems, message me and I'll pop into the group or help you where I can.
So for our roundtable discussants, David, Glyn, Matthias, Carl, and Edgar, Do we want to put them into groups as well?
Yeah, it's a bit of a roulette. So if you find that there are two roundtable participants in the group, can one of you drop out and go, we'll put you into another group? That's the easiest way. I can't allocate you to something without allocating everybody. Yeah.
So we've got a nice spread of our lovely experts that have kindly given their time. That'll be brilliant. So in terms of timings, colleagues, for this humongous task, I think we're going to allocate 20 minutes. So what time are we on now? So if we could reconvene at 16:45, 5:15, that's UK time. So 2:15, wherever you are in the world, that would be fantastic. And if you could just put your questions or statements in the chat for each of the breakout rooms, and then we'll all come back together and we'll discuss your points and we'll put these to our experts today. Does that sound fabulous?
Great. I'll send everybody into chat.
So enjoy your discussions, colleagues. And I look forward to the outcomes. Thank you. So I'm looking forward to hearing what you discussed. For our roundtable guests. You were obviously participating in the breakout sessions. Does anyone want to start with some points that they picked up in their breakout session that they attended?
We looked at in the group looked at question two.
Yeah.
In what ways can AI supported tools enhance relational, empathetic, and individualized rehabilitative work? And where might they risk undermining these core human processes? And we looked at chatbots. We had a discussion around chatbots and whether or not they could accurately represent human emotions and really empathize relate to people. So in that I found that a fascinating discussion. There are a lot of chatbots. Well, I'm aware of quite a few chatbots being used in sort of probation rehabilitation settings. Obviously that, you know, it's getting it right. We had there were conversations around whether or not chatbots might be too positive and how we might need to kind of moderate their output so that they wouldn't produce dependence and even sort of addiction to them. So there are quite a few sort of discussions around how you could adapt chatbots to do what you want them to do rather than produce another problem.
Yes. I'm interested, Matthias, your work's looking at sort of the use of AI, isn't it, in the judiciary in Brazil. Have you got any thoughts about how emotion can be designed in or what happens to emotions in that space? I'd be really interested in what you've got to say, Matthias, in terms of the judiciary.
So emotion, I don't think it really takes a front page on how those people are thinking and developing their systems. But I do know there are chatbots developed within our, you know, federal accountant court, you know, that dwells on the federal expenses and whatnot. They do have a chatbot that interacts with citizens, etc. And there's a preoccupation of it being very humane. Yes, there is that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I did not gather any data on how the judges perceived the interaction with the chatbots, you know, because most of them did use Gemini, Claude, and all sorts of other chatbots like that. They were not really interested in how the emotion played out in that kind of thing. They were much more interested in the accuracy of those tools. So most judges used those chatbots daily, and they reported good results with it. And most of them did note that they themselves tried to train those chatbots with their own information. So there might be some biasing towards how those judges already think about those questions that they were posing to the chatbots.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Carl, I'd be interested in what your thoughts are on emotion and the automation of social interactions.
Yeah. So we I wanted to use AI to note take and capture what we spoke about. We discussed again, and this is something we covered when I was at the workshop last week, is that human element is crucial to it, and that human in the loop But when we're talking about emotion, I raise a point around having the choice between both. I think that AI shouldn't be the default as a, well, this is the solution to the staffing crisis or something like that. But for me, like, thinking of someone who's neurodivergent, you know, if they have challenges with social situations, actually AI in that situation might be very useful for helping them converse what they're thinking about, but also having the ability to, yeah, make that choice themselves. But also the data that's used to fuel those AI responses is really, really important as to how it drives the conversation forward. What's the data built on, and how that matters with decision making. We spoke about the skills of a probation officer, for example. Their skills remain paramount, and AI shouldn't be the replacement for their skills. It should be, their skills should still be at the highest level. And, you know, we spoke about our own uses of AI where I'm now becoming a little bit lazier to the responses, and we're all probably a little bit guilty of that. And we're saying, right, how do we improve? How do we make that judgment? How is that, you know, that's crucial, because we can't lose the human element within that process. I will pause for now, otherwise I'll carry on speaking.
Oh, thank you. If I could invite Edgar. Edgar, what did your group discuss? I'm just trying to cover off on the topics that we've been challenged with, and I think it's really interesting what Matthias, David and Carl have said about this human in the loop, that there's pros and cons and the importance of people having choice and judgment and human oversight. Edgar, what did you discuss in your group that you attended? Which one of the topics did you look at?
We went for number three. Well, we'll talk about governance aspects, you know, around driven rehabilitation. And, you know, it was quite an interesting conversation because I think in my group, you know, I actually got to meet, you know, people who have been, who also involved in multi-sectoral, multi-institutional collaborative work around rehabilitation. And that was by design, Victoria, but I thought we had quite a lot in common, you know, working with multiple agencies, you know, digital transformation in prison settings. And I think what really came clearly was that, of course, we all know that AI feeds off data, and in multi-sector settings, how can we be able to leverage multiple data sets spread across different institutions, you know, cutting across institutional boundaries? How do we leverage that, you know, more effectively? Mm-hmm. And there was, you know, a lot of discussion around transparency of this data, integrity of this data. But also, of course, is always the politics of accessing this data, because it's not often that everyone is willing to share or avail their data sets for analysis and for training some of these AI models, you know, when it comes to production. And so the idea and what really emerged from our conversation is that it's very important that we create mechanisms and definitions of who owns the data and, you know, how can we be able to effectively share it and for what purpose, because also elements of abuse, especially when it comes to, you know, some of this vast amount of data that, you know, can be easily available. And we all know that some of it is quite private and personal identification data. But I think at the end of the day, the idea was that let's be in a place and position where we create some of these mechanisms, some of them at a technical level, but also administrative level, so that everyone knows exactly the mechanisms and the protocols for effectively using this data across different stakeholders, And I think not just within government, but also how do you avail this data? Some of the non-state actors that would want to maybe come up with some of these innovations. And I'm from government, and typically we want to hold on to our stuff. You know, we don't want anyone to look at it. But we all know that we don't have all the solutions in the world, Victoria. You know, at some point we have to be able to open up and be able to engage with all the other players, and maybe they have some innovative ideas and solutions, you know, when it comes to how they can effectively leverage data, and not just from prison settings, but also from, let's say, police, because there's a lot of predictive analysis that goes into rehabilitation work. How do you come up with ideas and solutions that actually work, that can be able to, for example, to prevent reoffending? You don't have to look at one data set in that case. You're probably looking at a lot of data that cuts across various agencies, and police is just one of them, maybe also the judiciary. And it's quite dynamic, and I thought we all agreed that how we create structures and be able to define the rules collectively, I think that's very important, and for the greater good, and I guess everyone gets to benefit, including those in private, or let's say in private practice, or those in the civil society space. And maybe lastly, that's the only way that we can also inspire innovation. We have not really done so much in AI-driven probation or rehabilitation here in Uganda. It's just work in progress. We're trying to put in place frameworks for that to work. But how do we ensure that we also inspire innovation, you know, from other players who have a couple of wonderful ideas? How do we give them the space for them to leverage the kind of data that we have in our repositories to be able to come up with new ways of doing things? And so, very interesting conversation. I'm really curious to hear what everyone else has to say about that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'd like to bring Glyn in. Glyn, your service deals with big data, right? And this is a very small part of rehabilitation, isn't it, in terms of assisting people to recover from substance misuse. Your headaches around data and data sharing, and I'm just trying to kind of invite you to think about, you know, mechanisms of good practice that you've developed across your services, or any other thoughts about what Edgar's saying, you know, those headaches.
it's within that kind of that area of work. It's as Edgar's kind of saying, it depends on the purpose. So it's particularly within substance use, the people we support, people get assessed to death at every point of the criminal justice system, at every supporting agency that people are involved with. They get asked the same questions, but equally, you know, there's something about ensuring that questions are being asked with a particular purpose, not just because we've always asked them. And within the realms of digital, of course, lots of data is being captured, but along with all of the kind of qualitative, the sort of subjective personal information that's being collected, we're also in the background collecting lots of other useful and interesting information in terms of stuff that can tell us what's going to result in potential outcomes, what's going to, you know, are there particular demographics because of the volume of data that's being collected that can show us trends and help us to kind of figure out how better we can kind of implement the interventions and services, and what else we can be doing. You know, there are times of the day when digital can be providing a service because the in-person service just physically isn't there. So there's lots of data, but of course, where it gets challenging is looking at different jurisdictions, different parts of the world where you have to have data sovereignty. Because, for example, we're just in the process of mobilizing our programs within France. And we've only just come to realise this week that you can't there's certain data around ethnicity, for example, that you can't ask the questions.
Mm.
Whereas in every other part of the world, our assessment process is very formulaic. Mm. But because of legislation, we're not able to ask people their cultural identity, their ethnicity for legal reasons. Mm. But yeah, I mean, when it comes to kind of big data, it's I think with all of the discussion around AI technology, particularly within prisons or other criminal justice settings, it's still so embryonic that we, I think, are kind of making lots of assumptions and kind of based on our own experiences of AI to date, which for a lot of us is ChatGPT or kind of equivalent products, where when you're going to have sector specific platforms, those will be, you would hope, a lot more kind of finessed, targeted, but they're going to take time to mature and kind of from that there'll be lots of kind of outcomes, including ones that we never anticipated.
Thank you, Glyn. Could I ask you, whilst you're in the front and centre, were you in a different group? Did you cover another topic? What was it that you covered in your group? And perhaps you...
Unhelpfully, we had a general discussion around the role of AI and digital, and it tended to reflect the discussions we had last week, which kind of varied from the practical application of stuff like AI. How would that affect rapport between probation staff and individuals? And could the fact that you've got it running in the background free up, you know, your body language to have a more engaging conversation? But equally, how would that affect the kind of responses, and are people being more guarded in terms of what they're saying because they're being recorded? And yet that can be used as evidence to support claims or whatever's being discussed. And along with that, we were talking about the practicalities of how digital, particularly within the prison environment, is still within England and Wales, a postcode lottery, trying to look at digital transformation in the Victorian prison estate is really challenging. And then you've got new builds where people have got population-wide incel technology. And really, there was kind of a lot of discussion around, you know, the need to ensure that, for example, it's not just having the IT infrastructure and the hardware and technology in place, but it's the staff culture and the implementation processes that are equally as important, because you need the buy-in and staff at all levels to be on board in order to... Yeah. realize the potential of digital. And so a lot of this stuff I know we know and we've discussed it, but I think when we're looking at AI, we've got to get the basics right in the first place, particularly within England, Wales, where, you know, some prisons, the, you know, connectivity is still a massive issue. Or, you know, the fact that the HMPPS have rolled out 1,000 laptops, secure laptops across the prison estate. You'll go to one prison where you've got staff that have really embraced it, find it really engaging, delivering sessions with people on the landings. And then you've got others where you go there and the staff haven't taken it out of the box because they're afraid of using technology and being shown up using it in front of individuals that they're trying to support. And so, again, you've got, I think, just to get the real basics in place. Because, again, there's a risk with AI that the prison system will lag behind, as it has done with lots of other aspects of modernisation. So it's trying to win hearts and minds, but at all levels, really.
Colleagues, oh, we've got some hands up. Carl, thank you, Glyn. That's really insightful. Thank you. Carl. I think you're on mute.
Oh, how many times have we said that before? Finger the ass on how to use this now. But the design of these systems with lived experience at the very forefront, and practitioners and users being able to have input on the development and design of these, I think is paramount. And I think that's often missing from the conversation, isn't it? How do we, these conversations around data and how we, and concerns around privacy, et cetera, canvassing prisons, and asking them what their concerns are and using that within development will give us the answers, I think, that we're looking for here.
Thank you. Excellent point. Helen.
On mute. Yeah, I probably just didn't want you to pass on without the final group, really.
Yes, yeah, okay, yeah. No, I was coming to that. And when yeah, colleagues have been talking,
that's fine.
I'll put this to our round table people. Is digital repurposing rehabilitation? Is it shifting what rehabilitation is or means? Is it shifting how we deliver rehabilitation?
Can I tell you what the final group, what the last group was talking about then?
Yes,
thank you. I mean, very briefly, I really want to say that our group started out with a bit of a plea, really, to know more about where there are examples of using AI that is human and relational. We were looking at question two. And I think it is a bit of a plea from everyone in our group to know more about the systems that are, that one would consider to be successful. So that was the first thing. The second thing, we had a really interesting conversation about the potential for AI and platforms that can join up the helping systems for people coming out of prison. Katie Savage from Revolving Doors was with us in our group, and Katie was talking about, you know, how disjointed rehabilitative support in the community is and how people have to tell their story over and over again. And notwithstanding all the importance of all of that being, you know, kind of very carefully monitored and reviewed, how wonderful it would be if you didn't have to tell your story every time and the organisations that were in the community to support you were connected, you know, and you knew they were connected. And that brought us to really the importance of the voice of the service user in developing and looking up systems and the potential actually for then enhancing the use of lived experience. So I think, you know, that was a really rich discussion that we had there. We then, because of that, we were talking about the importance and the benefits of AI development by small companies rather than big tech. We got Jay Wood from Sherlock AI with us, who talked quite a bit about Sherlock AI. And what I think is quite interesting about that is that this appears to be a small, it's a CIC that's been brought together by people whose purpose was initially about supporting people coming out of prison and rehabilitation. And they kind of came with their purpose to AI and IT rather than the other way around. And I think that, you know, makes them quite an interesting company, because we did talk quite a bit then about breaking free of big tech. And I think, you know, kind of that would be an interesting topic to return to at some point. So, yeah, some really interesting stuff. Thank you.
Oh, great. Okay. Does anyone want to ask any questions or make some comments about the topics that we've covered this afternoon? I could invite our roundtable experts. I'm really interested in international comparisons here. I'm in relation to this. So is anyone, I know there's lots of comments, some really interesting comments in the chat here. And many of you have touched upon reducing reoffending and recidivism and whether or not technology can be assistive in that enterprise. Any thoughts on that? I think it was a comment, several comments in relation to that.
I'm quite interested, Victor, in user empowerment, because there are lots of concerns around AI, but, you know, at least a couple of sort of good uses, I would say, of AI are, you know, certainly going on in England and Wales. And I mean, one of them, for instance, is using a chatbot as an AI learning assistant to people who are training. And lots of people have found that very useful to them in the early stages of their probation officer training. And also the big one, certainly for His Majesty's Prison and Probation Service in England and Wales, is AI transcription, which was piloted in Wales and over in Kent, Surrey and Sussex initially. And that has been very, very well received by practitioners, with many people who were skeptical about it, could have bowled over by it once they'd used it. And so that, and the people who are implementing it were almost embarrassed by the success of it, because, obviously you learn quite a lot when you're implementing something by people criticizing it. But what found is that, 85, 95% of people using it sort of said how great it was. Those are just a couple of kind of positives, really, because, and also one quick mention, but, building on what Carl said, but tools that are actually designed to be used by users, to kind of build them. So, you build the tool that will be useful to you. And there's some work going on around that at the moment, which I think is very useful.
Fantastic. Thank you, David. That's really helpful. Welcome, Liliana. I'll come to you next, Edgar, if that's okay. Liliana.
Thank you. Hello. I've heard a lot and about very interesting topics. I just want to address your question. Could AI be helpful in rehabilitation? I'm a frontline practitioner. I'm a probation counselor in Romania. For me, at this moment, given the caseloads of me and my peers, at this moment, AI would be very helpful if it would reduce the paperwork and allow me more time, one-on-one time, and real authentic possibility to connect with the people in my caseload. This would be very helpful. I've heard a lot about big data, who owns the data, what they do. I'm a frontline practitioner. For me, these are not questions that I have the time space or the headspace to concern myself with. But for me, it would be very helpful if, just as I think David and also Glenn mentioned in the UK, AI coming in and helping with specific tasks, that would be very helpful, just to answer your question quite shortly. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Liliana. Thank you. So the realities of frontline work and the pressures that our sector are, increasingly under. Edgar, thank you.
Well, I just wanted to jump on what David said. And, he's saying, basically underlining the importance of accountability, transparency, and oversight. And I think Jay Wood, from Sherlock AI, wanted to, be a bit controversial. But, I don't think it is controversial. He's basically saying that, we need to do things differently. And I agree with both, actually. And I'm just saying that how do we strike that balance? Because, you also don't want to overregulate and, overgovern AI, implementations. You want to sort of create an environment where there is a balanced act. And I'm thinking, in my world, how do we actually make sure that these tools work you know, in a more practical sense, and you just heard, you know, our frontline use cases. I mean, you just want solutions. You want answers to be, you want some of your questions to be answered. And the question is, how do we balance the need to roll out these technologies, but also at the same time, make sure that they're not misused? And so it's something that it's like a delicate dance of sorts, but I think it's something that we need to carefully consider so that there is a more balanced act at the end of the day. Because I think both Jay and David are certainly right. I just wanted to comment on that. I thought it was quite interesting. Yeah.
Thank you, Edgar. Jay, since you got a name drop there, do you want to come in and say anything to us all in response to what Edgar's just said?
Well, yeah, I mean, the main thing is that I deal specifically with the prison leaver group, right? So that's our kind of our kind of focus. There's a huge problem with trust within this cohort. So, like, I hear that the probation, they can use tools for support and kind of learning about people. That's great. However, it's difficult for us to kind of build a tool set that is wrapped around the probation world that would appeal to prison leavers, because there's still that massive trust gap. So we're almost creating something that is away from the probation service and from those tools. As we are your friend. We are a peer group supporting you in wards that work for you. It's almost like rejecting the current support network and creating something groundswell for the user based on what the users want in a way that wraps around them. And we can also do it in a secure way by not using the big tech world. So yeah, I can talk for days on this. So
I mean,
the main point is that the as we can see from the stats, you know, it's all kind of, it's not going well as far as the criminal justice world is, and we need new technology, new ideas to finally break free and make some serious progress in changing those stats.
Thank you, Jay. Yes, the topic of trust, and, you know, we're talking about people that experience justice, often purported to be low trust environments. And that I think that also impacts practitioners as well, right? In very, very similar ways. And then when we start to think about certain groups within justice, gender differences, neurodiversity, age, different ethnic groups, for example, and how do we begin to address their needs in that space, and what happens to, as you say, Jay, around those trust issues. Any other comments? I know we're sort of running out of time. Could I take a couple more comments? It'd be great to have some more. What I wanted to ask was Matthias about Brazilian judges and trust. Are you still there, Matthias?
Yes, yes.
And just, yeah, what do you think about trust for judges?
But firstly, I would like to add on what Liliana was talking about, because that's a very, very, very important point. Because, sorry, my dog is getting to the picture here. It's a very important point because the first line practitioners, they live a very different situation that when we are considering a strategic implementation of AI. As she said, you know, she's not really really interested in the ethical questions with the data sets and etc., because the workload is so massive that we need a little bit more time for doing a bit more qualitative work rather than quantitative work, you know. And if the tools help us do that, that's marvelous. At that first plane of thinking, we're not really interested if there are many risks involving that, because when we speak about first line practitioners and whatnot, the people in the front. And specifically what Liliana pointed out, that administrative and paperwork, you know, tasks that we have to clear out before doing the real work, you know, the descriptive work, the really fine detail work, that's something that is already happening and it's already being very productive. I mean, simply put, it's being productive because the AI can do organization tasks. It can, you know, sort documents. It can summarize stuff. And it's a kind of an innocuous task, you know. There's not much risk involved, and it's what I would consider a low risk situation of using those AI tools. So, for those matters, we see those two, the use of those tools. We still don't have factual numbers regarding the amount of productivity those tools brought out to the table, you know, for those practitioners, but it does help. But regarding that and linking up to your question on trust, when we see the implementation of those tools, you know, they are promising productivity and accelerating your work and leaving out some time for you to do some more substantial stuff regarding your cases, you know, looking into the fine print of it all. What we see is if the judges and the practitioners and the employees are not really knowledgeable on AI and are not really, you know, still very connected with how to use those tools, they might just lose more time than gain time using those tools, sadly, because they will be caught on some other stuff, you know, regarding training those tools and et cetera, if it hasn't been done right, or if they didn't receive enough instruction on how to use those tools. So maybe they just might be running in circles trying to use it and not be productive. One of the judges I interviewed, he really said that he himself was trying to find a way to use the chatbots to give him out the right suggestions, but he couldn't still get a result that was explainable and transparent and really followed his logic. So I think he's actually losing time trying to teach the tool to make what he wants instead of going into his cases and studying them by himself. And regarding trust, if you want to add something, Victoria, I'll be done just in a minute. Regarding trust, the judges, the ones that know the AI world and AI tools, they themselves fear those tools a lot. They fear the use of those tools. They fear the results. But they are, in a sense, very limited in the imaginary of how the institution is going to be in the future because they don't see themselves without those tools anymore. They see a future that is full of AI, that is full of more tools, more automation, and even generative AI in the play. So they don't see themselves exempt of using those tools, but still they fear it a lot. So there's a trust issue there that's very important.
Thank you, Matthias. Those insights from your research are brilliant for us all. I'm conscious of time. We've got 6 minutes left. We've got one hand up, which is very circular. Simon, you started this conversation. So let's perhaps end with your question and then we can have a close to the session. Clearly lots to discuss. Simon.
Yeah, just really quickly on trust. And I think this is, you know, I think Helen touched on this at the outset. And I guess the question I would have is, I can appreciate that the having trust issues with something new, artificial intelligence, technology, modernization. But how much trust do we have or can we have in paper-based systems or fragmented data or manual processes? And the limited transparency that comes along with that, the inconsistent access to services, inequitable exclusions. I just wonder, we talk about the future and trust and transparency and things of that nature, but how much trust and transparency do we have in the current process, and should we be comparing those two? And I'll just leave that as an open question.
Yeah, thank you. Any final comments from what Simon's just said there, colleagues? No, and that's interesting, isn't it? It's sort of we get bogged down in and I think as Liliana explained in terms of her daily practice, the frustration of being bogged down in paperwork and administration. Martina.
Hi, Vic. Thanks. I just wanted to come back maybe on Simon's point, and I accept what he's saying around the current shortcomings of the various criminal justice systems. I mean, there's no questions around, we know about the levels of exclusion, we know about the level of discrimination in the system and biases in the system. But it's not as if AI is coming in as a neutral savior for us in this space. A lot of AI products are built on data that is based on the current unequal systems. So the idea that AI will be less biased and less detrimental to individuals in the system is something that needs to be tested. We cannot take this as a given. So there's a real danger here that we're thinking, oh, the technology will be unbiased. It doesn't look like a human, doesn't think like a human, but it is, and we know this, and particularly from research in the US and other places, that actually AI comes with a lot of inbuilt biases. And that's why testing and understanding how these systems are rolled out, why I think there is a need for care, and there is a need for really thinking through what you're implementing, when you're implementing it, and what effects it might have.
Yes, and colleagues, Carl mentioned this, Glenn mentioned this, the kind of oversight and human in the loop practice and informed kind of engagement, the idea of people co-designing solutions that may help to overcome some of these real fears. There's clearly a lot to discuss here, colleagues, and we've got so much material that has been presented today. I wasn't privy to the breakout groups, so I'm really looking forward to, in say, CJ and the Probation Institute, digesting the material that's been discussed amongst colleagues. First and foremost, I'd like to really give a big thanks and a virtual round of applause to our experts, David Rahu, Edgar, Matthias, Carl and Glyn, who accepted our invitation to help us put this together. So thank you, everybody, and thank you for, I've not really had time to catch up with the what's in the chat. It became very, very active as we all came together and were discussing some of the points. Helen, can I hand over to you to say anything about next steps in terms of NCJ and Probation Institute's plans, please?
Yes, I'll try. I mean, I think it's been absolutely fascinating, and I suppose where I end up is I'd like to be confident that Liliana can be confident that when she's using that AI is no less risk-free than the current systems, and I think that would be a good place to be. We will take all of this. The likelihood is that we will try and pull all of this together into a document which we'll probably call it something like a position paper. It's not a policy or a strategy. It's just kind of, you know, as a result of the benefit of so much helpful thinking, this is where we kind of have arrived at. But I think we'll try to tease out in there some principles, and some kind of balancing of the risks and issues and the benefits, which, you know, absolutely are untold and undoubted, but none of that comes without a lot of caveats. if that's helpful. I just, if I could add my thanks to everyone, actually, because I think in the breakout groups and also our expert group, it has been an extremely rewarding session. And I hope you'll come and talk to us about this again soon.
Yeah. Thank you, colleagues. Lovely to see some new faces. I wish we were all together and seeing some new faces and some old faces. So thank you very much from me.
You have been listening to the INCJ podcast, Conversations about International Criminal Justice. To find out more, go to our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net. or follow us on Twitter at INTCJ Network.